Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our Southwest studios. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're talking about robotics and automation in the workplace. Earlier on, the first few segments, we're going to be talking to a panel that visited the University of Wisconsin La Crosse prior to COVID-19, and we've put that program together a while ago, and now we're able to bring it to you today. Later in our program, find out how automation is affecting the dairy industry. We talk to a Wisconsin-based business involved in the dairy industry. That's all coming up on Newsmakers. As I said, our panelists today were here for a discussion about robotics at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse during the spring semester, early in the spring semester, before COVID-19 sent us all working from home and closed the campus. So we start by introducing the panelists.
T.J. Brooks is the chair and professor of economics and finance at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Steve Hine from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. Steve, thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
We have Dr. Mark Sawyer, who's a surgeon with the Mayo Clinic Health Systems here in La Crosse and Rochester. Dr. Sawyer, thank you.
It's my pleasure.
And Marisa Pruitt, who is the Robotic Surgery Program Manager at Gunderson Health Systems. Marisa, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So this whole issue of robotics, we're going to focus a lot of attention on the medical side of it and how it's affecting that industry coming up very soon. First, I want to just get into the issue in general. It seems like, I mean, there have always been aspects of robotics in the workplace. As soon as they could figure out how to have a robot arm put a windshield on a car or something like that. But it really seems like in the last 5 or 10 years, the public is hearing more about how automation is becoming a regular part of life. Steve, do you want to talk about how that's occurring?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's a distinct difference between, you know, a robot arm putting a windshield in a car on an assembly line from the kind of technology that we're witnessing today, what's often referred to as artificial intelligence or machine learning. But, you know, the application of much greater computing capacity, large data sets that allow pattern recognition and responsiveness in those robots, if you will, that were not part of the game, you know, as assembly lines became automated. So it's the kind of technology that is going to have much more expansive impact than just those office jobs and factory floor jobs that were automated over the decades since the microchip came along. The medical field is a very good example, we'll hear about that. But everything from autonomous vehicles and planes to automating practically every kind of occupation that we can think of has tasks associated with it that to some degree or another are susceptible to automation in the light of this artificial intelligence that's becoming more prominent.
I think anybody who follows the news has seen the pros and cons of like automated Uber vehicles or, you know, automated drones to make deliveries for Amazon or whatever. What are some ways in which automation is being used that might surprise people that we maybe are less aware of?
There's lots of things in the medical world.
Yeah.
Just a few examples that we've been talking about is there are artificial intelligence programs that will look at a patient's physiology on the intensive care unit and send an alert page to doctors if the pattern looks worrisome. I just ordered my newest digital stethoscope, which has artificial intelligence algorithms built into it so it can recognize things like atrial fibrillation and pathologic murmurs with far greater sensitivity and specificity than a general practitioner. And so those sorts of things are, you know, behind the scenes. There's a form of the stethoscope just got a little bulb on the end. You wouldn't even know it as a patient that the doctor is using that technology. And robotics and surgery is becoming a hot thing, and there are There are master-slave systems like the Da Vinci where the surgeon uses that, but there are also ones that are do semi-autonomous tasks like drilling out the bone for a joint replacement.
You talked about it being involved in every industry, Steve, that we can think of. And I think of my own industry of broadcast journalism. We don't so much use robots, but there are computer programs used by the Associated Press and others where repetitive articles that have that are just simply based on facts can now be written by computers and distributed without ever a human eye editing them or seeing them. And they do this for certain kinds of sporting events. A reporter will collect the necessary statistics. They'll upload the, or even a team manager of some kind will upload the statistics into the system, who gained what yardage or scored which points or hit which ball where. And the computer system will just generate a story that's then sent to stations all over, no one ever being the wiser that this was not written by an actual physical reporter. So it really is. This technology and automation really is everywhere, isn't it?
With perfect grammar and spelling, no doubt.
Yeah. Well, more perfect grammar than me,
than humans, right?
Yeah.
I think that's one area where we've seen a lot of progress lately is like natural language processing, image classification, those types of places where we've really seen a boom lately. And that's provided the ability to sort of write those stories that are just an assembly of some facts that are then given a little bit of context automatically.
So when one company figures out a way to automate a certain part of their process, that's one thing. But like when it starts happening on a much larger scale like we're seeing now, it begins to have an effect on that company's ability to operate efficiently and make money. On the other hand, the availability of those jobs in the community. How is this issue starting to affect our economy?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that automating tasks within occupations does not necessarily mean the occupation is reduced somehow in terms of employment or the activities that an individual impacted like that faces. In many instances, the application of artificial intelligence enhances workers' productivity, would raise the demand for that kind of worker. So, you know, these alarmist forecasts that, well, you know, half of our jobs are susceptible to automation and therefore they're going to disappear is just not the way economists anyways are looking at this issue. It's going to change the way we do our work. It's when I say that it's ubiquitous. I mean, when we get in our car and program our directions to our next destination, we're using smart technology, artificial intelligence. So there's applications that we're seeing in essentially every area to some degree. Some areas are going to be impacted negatively. We still see a lot of potential for artificial intelligence, you know, really substituting for workers that perform very routine tasks. But at a time when we're facing worker shortages because of all those aging baby boomers, this is a fortuitous time to see us, you know, perhaps applying some of those technologies in areas that might otherwise have to fold up business because they don't find the workers that they need to keep operating.
So you talked about the worker shortage and this being a good time, coincidentally enough, for these advances in technology. Is it fair to say that some of these worker shortages might actually be pushing the research that's leading to the advancement in these technologies?
Perhaps it's certainly pushing the application of that technology into the workforce. Some applications are being brought to bear perhaps earlier than they would be if there were still an available surplus pool of, you know, workers available to work at cheap wages. That's not so much the case anymore. So businesses are having to look to technology to perform those tasks that might otherwise be produced by, you know, lower skilled people, perhaps more predominantly, you know, performing routine tasks, but increasingly even some of the more skilled and non-routine and more cognitive tasks are being performed by by artificial intelligence.
We talk about the global nature of our modern economy, but we're talking here on a local level. We're at a university in La Crosse. We're talking about the economy here in the Cooley region, in the Driftless area, in our part of Wisconsin and Minnesota. How can we tell how these issues are affecting us here on a regional basis? TJ, you want to take that one?
I think the only differences we might see with sort of other areas would come from sort of looking at the distribution of the types of employment we have here. Steve gave a presentation where he showed Wisconsin has more production manufacturing type occupations, which seem to be more susceptible to the automation process. So, you know, while I don't want to be alarmist either, it is one area of concern as sort of some of these the businesses automate. We have a sort of bigger impact here in Wisconsin in terms of employment effects from that.
We're talking with TJ Brooks, he's the economic and finance chair at UW-La Crosse. Also with us, Steve Hine from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. Coming up, we'll hear more from Dr. Mark Sawyer, who you heard from, a surgeon at the Mayo Clinic Health Systems, and Marisa Pruitt. I promise we're getting to you, Marisa, the robotic surgery program manager at Gunderson Health Systems. In fact, we're going to talk a lot about how these issues are affecting the healthcare community as our conversation continues. For now, if you would like to get in touch with the show, you can find us on our website. It's wpr.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Newsmakers continues in a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studios. We've been hearing from our expert panel talking about robotics, and this is a conversation that took place in our studios pre-COVID-19, and we're able to bring it to you now. It features TJ Brooks, the economics and finance chair at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Steve Hine of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, Dr. Mark Sawyer of the Mayo Clinic Health System, and Marisa Pruitt of the Gunderson Health System. She's the robotic surgery project manager. Marisa, we haven't heard from you yet, but you oversee programs at Gunderson involving robotic surgery, bariatric surgery, those kinds of things. Talk about how technology and robotics play a role in your clinical setting.
The technology piece is fascinating, and it's exploding in terms of adoption, both from the surgeons that I work with and also from the patients in our community. And so I think the main point that I want to make first off is, Dr. Sawyer alluded to this before, is the surgical robots that we are using are called slave systems. The surgeon is in control of the robot at all times, and all of the movements that the surgeon makes are very uniquely and microscopically articulated into the hands of the robot.
So while this is robotics, it isn't automation.
Correct.
Okay.
Although it is changing our workforce.
Yet.
Thank you. Yes. Interestingly, the surgical robots that we are using were designed to be used on a battlefield where the surgeon would be removed from the battlefield, but the robot would be doing the work. And that whole telesurgery idea, I think, is what's next in surgical robots. I think we're going to see more and more where the surgeon is removed from that operating room, still probably in control of the procedure for the most part, but not in the sense that we've historically known.
It's an active area of research. The initial robotic systems in the mid-80s, Colonel Dr. Rick Satava was head of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project, and this was one of his projects, the idea being the surgeon is here and the robot is on the battlefield, and there are issues with that. You've got to have a perfect connection. You can't drop the connection. If there's any old school gamers out there, there's a ping time. You know, it takes so many milliseconds for the signal to go from the surgeon's console to the robotic console and back again. So you know, when you have a bleed, there can't be a big delay, and that's the delay is compounded by distance. So there are some limiting factors there. But right now, when we do a case, I'm sitting at the console in the operating room, and the patient's about 8 feet away. But there's a push to try and do things from other rooms to test the concept of how far can you be away from the patient and still have a safe surgery.
I guess in modern times, a surgeon would learn how to use these technologies while they're in their internship or their residency or in their education process. But as newer technologies come out and develop, how are medical professionals educated on their proper use?
Well, the Intuitive company that makes the Da Vinci robot has training sessions, and you sign up and you go, and it's a couple days where you learn. Well, there's actually some online teaching modules, and then you go and actually get some training in the robot. I think it's important to note that these are just tools, okay? We do laparoscopic, which is the little incision surgery, and we put instruments through those that are kind of stiff sticks with, you know, scissors and clamps and things on the end that just open and shut. The robot gives you some wrist action, some articulation, so you can be more accurate. But really, it's just a tool that translates the surgeon's actions. And it feels more natural, to me anyway, to use the robot to do surgery than the laparoscopic, where your motions are more constrained.
And our surgeons go through a robust proctoring experience as well. There's a steep learning curve with robotic surgery, and so we know that and anticipate that, and so we invite skilled surgeons in an area of expertise, hernias or you know, the like, and have that surgeon in the room with our training surgeon so that we're getting quality advice and direction on how to best use that surgical robot tool in the procedure.
Do patients know ahead of time? I mean, you think of surgery and you're thinking of what we've seen on TV or in the movies or what some of us have experienced in different parts of life maybe years ago. But are patients aware of just how much technology is involved in these surgical procedures now? And does that give them any concerns?
I think patients are seeking it out. I think they want the best outcomes. They want to get back to their lives as quickly as possible, their jobs, their kids, you know, whatever it is. And they also want to have the best procedure possible. So our patients are well informed. They're seeking out robotic surgery. They believe that option will give them improved cosmesis, less scarring. It will help them with pain management, or, you know, reduce the amount of pain that they'll have postoperatively, or that they'll be able to return to work faster. And so they're seeking those options out. But I think that it still goes back to, in that exam room before the procedure happens, the patient's educated on all of the options that are appropriate for them, and the patient and the surgeon determine what procedure is going to be the best in their situation. So it's still a conversation. Not every patient that walks through the door is going to get a robotic procedure at our facility, but it's definitely in the conversation.
In other industries that are affected by the improvements in technology, you see greater efficiencies. I know you don't like to think of people's healthcare as a matter of efficiency, but is there an aspect of that in this? Does this allow you to serve more patients, or how do you look at the technology in terms of your ability to service your patients?
Well, I'll use the example of an inguinal hernia, a groin hernia, and when I first started doing them robotically, I'd given a pretty even-handed presentation to the patient. We can do it with the robot, we can do it straight laparoscopically, or I can do it with an incision. And the recurrence rate for the hernia is pretty much the same, no matter which way you do it. And I'd explain that the robot gives me a little more control, and I could do laparoscopic cases that I would not do without the robot. But giving an even-handed approach, I would say probably roughly 3/4 of my patients would choose the robot. So patient demand is driving a lot of this.
Do you see a time in the future, or maybe it already exists? I don't know. I don't obviously perform surgery, but like it where a an upcoming generation of surgeons is so native to the idea of using robotic technology to perform these tasks that they're like their hands on, like if they were required to do it hands on like them like themselves, would that ability be lost, or do you see that ability being sort of losing place as generations of surgeons continue?
I don't think so for a few reasons. Number one is the robot right now is much more faithful in translating the actions. It makes it feel much more like live surgery. We have simulation labs now where the residents practice before they ever get near a human being. And there are certain levels of competency you have to have before you're allowed to progress to the next levels. I think the percentage of cases is going to go more and more robotically. And if you want to look even further into the future, there are master-slave systems now just doing what the surgeon tells them, but there's going to be more and more autonomy in these systems as time goes on and the artificial intelligence improves. And somebody's predicted that, you know, my job as a general surgeon might be done by autonomous robots by 2060. So
I take that as you will. Dr. Sawyer pointed out earlier that some of this robotic technology allows people, let's say, with a hand tremor to still perform surgery. And so that's an example of someone who the hand tremor might be so serious they couldn't actually perform that surgery sort of the old-fashioned way, but the robot and AI technology allows them to perform that surgery. So, I do think that some of that skill might be lost. I mean, eventually, if it's completely autonomous, we could imagine sort of losing that skill like we're losing the skill to write in cursive.
And is that important? Because right now, when you hook the bowel together, you can do it by sewing. You can use a surgical stapler that does it much quicker than the human hand can sew, and the leak rate is the same. So the question is, the technology it changes, but it's going to be better at doing it. So is it really important that the surgeons lose that particular ability? I can't trip in somebody's skull like they did, 1,000 years ago, but that's not an important skill anymore.
Technology is, I mean, I'm just going to be blunt about it. Technology is expensive. Having all this equipment in the surgical suite with us costs a ton of money. Do we know, is there data available that shows how these things affect cost to either patients or to insurance companies?
I can say with certainty that robotic surgery will be very costly to an organization who's not fiscally responsible. I can also say that if there are not cost containment strategies or data analytics in place, that this can get out of hand quickly because, to your point, new technology is expensive. I think as time goes on, these technologies will become more mainstream and their price tag will decrease over time. But I think it's important that we as healthcare institutions really look at what does it cost us to do these procedures? How can we reduce the variation from surgeon A to surgeon B to surgeon C in a similar procedure so that we can contain those costs and make sure that our patients aren't burdened with extra healthcare costs? On the flip side, while the capital investment on the front end is significant for an organization, where an organization is going to recoup those costs is helping patients get out of the hospital faster. And what we've found with our robotic procedures is our patient's length of stay in the hospital is cut in half from going from an open procedure to a robotic procedure. Their complication rates are significantly less, so they're coming back into the hospital less often for readmissions. They're having less complications. And those are costly to not only the patient, but the organization itself.
Now, complications do happen. I mean, they're inevitable. They do happen from time to time. You're going to have some level of them. When people do experience complications from a surgery like this, do you find it easier, harder to address them? You mentioned they happen less frequently on a statistical basis.
Complications happen as part of any surgery. It's an interesting, I used the example when we had the forum earlier about laparoscopic cholecystectomy versus an old open incision, taking the gallbladder out, all right? So when the laparoscopic, meaning again, this minimal incisions, straight sticks, things like that came about, there was actually a higher incidence of damaging one of the structures called the common bile duct, which requires a big corrective surgery. But surgeons were slow to adopt laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and they're reluctant to abandon the open because they said, well, that's a terrible complication. It's a definitely higher incidence in the laparoscopic group. We don't want to do it. But patients demanded it. And if you didn't do them, they went to somebody who did. And within a few years, laparoscopic cholecystectomy became the standard. We got much better at predicting the anatomy to avoiding that particular injury, but it was the patients that drove that, not the surgeons. And I think it's the same thing with the robotic technology. If you're taking out a gallbladder now, you know, a general surgeon can, an uncomplicated gallbladder with straight laparoscopic sticks can do it in 20, 30 minutes. The robot probably it takes longer, takes time to set it up. But, you know, the technology is there to stay, and it's going to be used for more and more things. It's going to be a part of the cost of doing business. So
our conversation today is in part about how robotics affects the economy. As you see more and more robotics and more technology in hospital settings, in the surgical suite, in the clinic, what does that do to employment in terms of are you seeing more employees, more jobs being created in that environment to help operate this equipment, who are not necessarily surgeons, but the people who do the upkeep, do the updates, do the engineering, do the ongoing maintenance and that kind of thing?
I think the surgical robot is not replacing jobs necessarily, but it's definitely shifting the work and how people do work and who's doing that work. I mean, certainly a surgical robot needs regular maintenance and updates and things like that. It needs new software. And so that side of things is shifting. In the OR itself, we still need surgical assistants and circulating nurses and the same similar staff that were in the rooms before to help assist in that procedure. The work just looks a little bit different.
As we go forward, you know, right now when we move to more semi-autonomous systems, it still is going to require, at least for a time, supervision. And as Steve said, it's going to shift the jobs. You know, instead of a truck driver driving the truck, because the truck now drives itself, maybe he's the security guy or the guy that unloads the truck. So it'll shift things around.
That's Dr. Mark Sawyer, a surgeon in the Mayo Clinic Health System. Also, we've been hearing a lot this segment from Arisa Pruitt, the Robotic Surgery Program Manager at Gunderson Health System. With us today as well, Steve Hine from the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, and TJ Brooks, the Professor and Chair of Economics and Finance at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. I'm Ezra Wall. You're listening to Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Joining us today in our discussion about robotics is TJ Brooks, the Economics and Finance Chair at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, Dr. Mark Sawyer, surgeon at the Mayo Clinic Health System, Steve Hine of the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, and Marisa Pruitt, Robotic Surgery Program Manager at Gunderson Health Systems. Thank you again all for joining us. It's been a very interesting discussion so far. I want to veer back sort of in a more generalist part of the discussion about robotics and talk about some of the we've been hearing about the advances in the technology, but with that can come some misconceptions. And Steve and TJ, you caught me in one, in my assumption being that it necessarily makes things more expensive when you start involving bigger, more advanced technology. But you're saying that's not always the case, is it?
Well, no, it's not. I mean, the artificial intelligence is embedded in your phone. You know, we use it, whether we know it or not, quite frequently. Dr. Sawyer has mentioned his new stethoscope, right, that uses artificial intelligence. Of course, the ultimate decision as to whether to adopt a technology or not is in part based on whether the cost of doing so makes sense and all factors considered. You know, so So the cost may be a consideration when you imagine, you know, technology as being, you know, huge robots on a factory floor. But, you know, we're seeing technology take the form of the application of computer codes and big data sets and the computing capacity that we have. Oftentimes, it can be brought to bear relatively cheaply. Again, we see it, we're using it in our daily lives without necessarily recognizing it. We've talked about the other constraints or obstacles that people have recognized, including consumer acceptance of the use of technology, regulatory burdens in many instances, but certainly cost is a consideration, but not necessarily in many instances, a huge, overwhelming cost consideration.
Yeah, you might take an example like the Roomba, for example, and think about, you know, if you used to spend an hour of your time vacuuming your house, and now you've bought this technology that frees you from that task.
Now you spend an hour of your time fixing the Roomba.
if that's not always the case, right? So, I mean, what we clearly see is that this technology is being adopted, and it's being adopted in a way that makes our lives easier.
Yeah.
Right? So that's true. I mean, you can think about sort of the employment in the United States back in 1900 and all the farming we used to do and all the technology that's come online in farming. We have far fewer people that are required to work in farming. That's freed us up to do other things. So technology, whether it be robotics and AI, is all about sort of freeing people up to do other things. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, it depends upon the sort of initial cost of that technology and what it's freeing you up from doing. I think in plenty of areas you see that's cost effective.
Yeah, Dr. Sawyer.
And that, just to go back to the digital stethoscope, you know, before, and if you can imagine the patient, you send one home with a patient. And so now instead of the patient having to go for his, say he's had a heart attack, he needs weekly checkups with the doctor, but instead of having to drive into the hospital, park his car, go sit in clinic for an hour, he pulls out his iPhone, makes a telemedicine link to the doctor, puts the stethoscope on his chest, and holds it still for 30 seconds, and the doctor gets that information transmitted digitally. It's interpreted by the artificial intelligence, recognizes the murmur of the atrial fibrillation or not, and so now you've taken that patient's day and you've made it possible for him to get his care from home. The doctor maybe can see three or four more patients in the same amount of time because of the way the technology has enabled. So there are trade-offs, and the technology costs more, but you get something in return.
Before we wrap up this part of the conversation, this might be unfair. I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit and ask you to prognosticate, but you can do so in terms of what you know about your own industry, or take it from a more personal aspect of just what you're excited about seeing as a person. And I want to talk about technology that is on the horizon, or even technology that you just think would be cool, that maybe we haven't heard a lot about yet. What is coming up in terms of robotics, in terms of automation, in terms of including technology in healthcare or in farming or other aspects of our society that make you excited? What would you like to see next, or what do you think is going to happen next that might surprise people? Who wants to go first?
Well, I'm almost going to bail on this by noting what I did in the conference, and that is how terrible we have been in the past in predicting what kind of technology is here to stay. You know, quotes from people saying that, you know, the horse is here to stay and the car is a passing fad. TV is never going to catch on because who's going to want to sit and watch a plywood box?
Right.
There's never going to be a significant market share for the iPhone, and the internet is a flash in the pan. So not being a technologist of any stripe, being an economist, and based on that, I'm going to say, I have no idea what it's going to look like in the future, you know. I mean, you can imagine drones delivering our mail and packages and so on. But I think it's very difficult to predict. Perhaps in your field of study, and I'll be interested to hear what Mark and Marissa say. But you know, not being a subject matter expert in a particular field, but rather looking at the economy as a whole.
Yeah.
I'm just reluctant to even try to guess.
Yeah, I'm like Steve there. Years ago when the iPad came out, and before I had kids, I didn't understand the use case, so I predicted it wouldn't last. Mm-hmm. Now I have kids, I completely understand the use case. But I don't know that I can make any great forecasts. What I'm interested or excited about is sort of the like autonomous cars, for example, and the potential for dramatic savings in loss of life, right? So 45,000 people die a year in car accidents. That number might not go to zero, but it's going to drop dramatically. And I think those are, you know, amazing things that we have on the horizon. I look forward to hopefully all of the hurdles that we have to face, regulatory and otherwise, being overcome. But I'm very hopeful about all this technology.
Dr. Sawyer?
Yeah, so again, with the as I put my trauma surgeon hat on and look at autonomous driving, it may not be perfect, but they're going to be better than human drivers. They don't get drunk, they don't get distracted, they don't fall asleep at the wheel. And eventually the technology is just going to get better and better. In terms of surgery, they've done a proof of concept where they took two pieces of intestine and So the computer, the robot could know where the edge is, they put metal beads in. But as proof of concept, they had the robot sew the intestines together and then compared it with leak rate with a human surgeon. The robot was much better. And, you know, if you imagine that going forward, you look at the Da Vinci robots, which are master-slave right now, they have software that you use to train that simulate the patient. My prediction for surgery is that, which has become more and more minimally invasive, more and more things have gone to our interventional radiologists who do things with needles through the body wall with needles instead of knives. The AI is just going to get better and better, and surgery will be first partially autonomous and overseen by surgeons, and then the robots are going to be better at it than we are, and. You know, there's already things like stereotactic neurosurgery things in the brain where the computer system can know the exact angle to get exactly where it needs to do something to a lesion in the brain, whereas a surgeon it might be a little more guesswork. They're reaming out bones, things like that. There's already computers that can do it better than people. So that's my prediction for the longer term.
Marisa, what do you see on the horizon?
I see more and more AI in every aspect of our lives. I'm personally very interested in self-driving cars. Both my husband's family and mine are 7+ hours away from La Crosse, so we do a lot of traveling to visit family. And so I want to be able to just plug in the destination, back,
yeah.
Relax, and drive. That is like music to my ears. In terms of healthcare, I'm excited to see where it goes. I mean, we're already seeing robots where the robot does the colonoscopy in someone's home, you know, or yeah. Something like that. Like there's all sorts of really cool artificial intelligence coming our way, and I couldn't be the first to predict it, but I'm excited to see where it goes.
As for me, I'm a 1980s Back to the Future child still waiting for my hoverboard. We'll talk about robotics and get a look at it from the private sector point of view in a moment here on Newsmakers. But first, I want to thank our guests, Marisa Pruitt, the Robotic Surgery Program Manager at Gunderson Health System, Steve Hine, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, Dr. Mark Sawyer, a surgeon with the Mayo Clinic Health Systems, and T.J. Brooks, professor and chair of economics and finance at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. If you've missed part of the program today, or if you'd like to check out our archive, you can do so at wpr.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall, and this is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. You're on Newsmakers here from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios in La Crosse, and I'm joined on the telephone by John Seehafer, and we are continuing our discussion about automation and robotics and how that's making its way into the different aspects of our economy here in the Cooley region and the Driftless area, but throughout Wisconsin and the rest of the country as well. John is with Seehafer Refrigeration, and that is a company that makes the equipment and distributes the equipment that our farmers use to milk cows. So First of all, John, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So talk about this business, this refrigeration business, specifically selling and dealing with milking equipment. How long has your family been in that business?
Sure. My dad actually started the business in 1976. Started it by himself, just a one-man show, basically, servicing smaller farms, obviously. In 76, there was no 100, 200 cow farms at that time. So really, he started very grassroots with one or two customers and grew the business from there. As our market and as dairy farms have changed over the years, we've grown with that as well. So we've been in it for 40 plus years, and we'll be in it for another 40 years.
So as far as your involvement, were you born yet when your dad founded the company, or how long before you got involved?
So, yeah, I've been involved for the last 11 years. I came back to the business in 2009. I'll be 40 this year, so he started the business before I was born. I guess you'll say I grew up in the business. I have a finance degree from UW-La Crosse and went on, did my own thing for 5 years after college. Came back in 2009 and haven't looked back since. So my involvement has been since then. 6 years ago, I bought the business from my dad, and we started to develop some different automation. Started building our own PLCs and started to then in 2017 sell Lely robotic milking equipment and feeding equipment.
What's a PLC?
Programmable logistics control, and a PLC actually is a tiny little computer, basically, that we program to do certain things, and we use those in all different aspects of dairy farming, whether it be controlling pasteurization of milk, controlling cow movements, gates, basically you name it, we can use a PLC to control it.
So you talked about kind of the old days of dairy farming, and I know it's not 1976 isn't the old days like my great grandfather's days, but certainly it is a different animal, so to speak, than what we're dealing with now. How has the industry changed? How has dairy farming changed since those days in the 70s to now?
Yeah, so in the 70s, smaller farms mainly didn't have any hired labor. You know, the family would do most of the work themselves. And as time went on and farms got a little bit bigger, it became very common to hire, especially for your milking, to hire people to help with your labor. And as that grew through the 80s and 90s, into 2000s, the scales of farms have gotten bigger. Still the majority of our farms are owned by families, but they're milking more cows, they have more employees, and so the need for labor has really risen in the last 40 years exponentially.
So there are a lot, there have been milking machines for a long, long time and that sort of thing, but in terms of something that you would consider actually robotic or maybe completely automated or at least partially automated, what are those kinds of machines that are doing work in the dairy industry on a dairy farm?
So we kind of have two different main milking equipment, lines, we'll say. We have a conventional milking line that would require the user, the general labor person that's milking the cow, to actually attach the equipment that would milk the cow, okay? So that we consider that to be a conventionally milked system. And then we go into a robotic system that is completely autonomous and does not require anybody to be present in order for the cows to milk. So those two main lines, we've been doing the conventional milking for the last 40 years, and we've been selling and installing that type of equipment and maintaining it, for a long time. That's evolved as well. We have new technology there that gives us more information about the cow and about the milking and all of that. And then you take it to the next step and actually talk about robotic milking.
So when you're talking about the robotic milking, as you've described it. How different is that experience like for the animal that's being milked?
So the animal does not have any human interaction. She is literally in a freestall pen, and she's able to move about. She can lay anywhere she wants in the pen. She can eat whenever she wants. She can drink whenever she wants. Literally, she runs her own life. You know, there's never somebody in there moving her around. So the cows can milk anytime they want. And what's really neat about that is it totally takes the human interaction piece out of it. So the cows are really calm. They respond extremely well. Generally, we see more milk from the cows. We see less injury. We see less lameness. We see overall vet costs go down because they're just, you know, the cows are in their own environment and you know, they're living life the way they truly want to. The biggest thing that I feel that the general population needs to know is that, you know, we are doing these things for the goodness of our animals.
Yeah.
And for a quality product in the end of it.
Yeah.
And so many times that gets overshadowed by negative media.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, so it's important for our audience to know that we are doing these things and spending this capital because we want to take really good care of our animals, because when we do that, they give us quality milk. They give us a good amount of milk. And that's how a farm turns every day.
So you said the cows can milk whenever they want to. How does it work? Like, if I don't know if you could describe for us something that we can't see, but how does the mechanism actually happen?
So there's a stall in the barn that the cow is able to walk into by herself, and each cow has an individual ID tag that she wears. And so the minute she walks into that stall, she gets fed a little bit of grain, and we know, or pellet. So a little bit of a treat, you'll say.
Mm-hmm.
And we know exactly who that cow is because we read her collar. So we have a radio frequency tag on her. It says, you know, this is cow 1, 2, 3. We know who she is. We know where she is in her stage of lactation. We know how much milk she's expected to give us, and we know whether or not we're going to milk her. We're not going to milk her every time she walks into the stall, because a lot of times they're coming in just to get some feed. So she'll just basically walk right back out, and we won't milk her. But the cows that we are able to milk, then the gate will shut, and the robotic arm comes underneath her and then proceeds to milk her. so that's done completely automatic, and when that happens, the robot then takes all the information and all the data points that we receive from the robot and sends it back to the computer. And that is what the farmer is managing, basically managing the numbers instead of the daily labor tasks.
We have come a long way from the days of a kid with a bucket.
Absolutely.
Wow. So we just got a couple minutes left, and in that time, I'm interested in knowing where you see these trends going in the future.
Labor is hard to find, and whether it's general labor on a farm or, you know, labor in any other industry, we see issues with finding people to do the job. On top of that, the labor that we do find, we're having a difficult time, you know, getting that labor force to do what we need them to do day in and day out. The life of a cow is so much better when she is on schedule, when her routine is untouched. And so when we have a labor force we can't always count on, that's hard on the animal, and that's hard on the dairy farmer. So we are going to see a trend in robotics, and we will see that moving forward heavily. There's a very small percentage of cows in Wisconsin that are milked by robots right now, and like 2 or 3% basically of all the cows. So we're going to see a lot of robotic growth because of that. It's good for the animal. It's also good for the farmer.
John Seehafer from Seehafer Refrigeration, I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you very much for listening to our show on robotics here on WPR. We were talking to a panel earlier that convened at UWL pre-COVID-19, and we're bringing that to you now. And you can find it on our website along with our other programs as well. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Our producer is John Davis. For the rest of the crew here at WPR, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you next time on Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.